Welcome to Planetary Spirit, coming to you on ETIN, Emerson Talk and Information Network. My name is Jeff Ferranini, and I invite you on an exploration of spirituality. And my guest today is Dr. Rick Hansen, or Rick Hansen, Ph.D., who is a neurophysiologist, author, and teacher. And he is a summa cum laude graduate of UCLA and has founded the Wellspring Institute for Neuroscience and Contemplative Wisdom. He is also the author of his latest book, Buddha's Brain, The Practical Neuroscience of Happiness, Love, and Wisdom. So it is indeed a pleasure to welcome today to Planetary Spirit, Dr. Rick Hansen. Hello, Dr. Hansen. How are you?
Hi, I can hardly hear you. I'm sorry.
Okay, can you hear me any better now?
It's still pretty quiet, but I think I can track you.
Okay.
Yes, I can hear you, Jeff. This is fine.
That's better? Okay. Okay, good. All right. So I have to tell you, this was a very, very interesting as well as powerful book for me. I'm not a scientifically oriented person, although I do find science interesting when it's presented in a way that I can take bite-sized pieces of it and really enjoy it. And that's exactly what I found your book does. You're talking about the science of the brain, something that's really on the cutting edge of science and our understanding of the human psyche. This is really the almost getting into the final frontier, to quote Star Trek. But what I really wanted to start this conversation off with is something that you said in the beginning of the book that just kind of piqued my curiosity. You said, and let me just see if I can find it, somewhere where you said that when you were a young boy, you were standing outside your home and you were looking at a field across the way. And in the distance were these twinkling lights. And you said you wanted to somehow find your way to those lights, and you wanted to, in order to empower yourself, and you said that if something is going to happen, it needs to happen because of the actions I take. But there was something else that kind of came up for me when I heard that. I said, okay, here's a man who's self-empowered and bringing that energy in. But there was something about those twinkling lights that felt like there was something beyond your grasp that you got into contact with, into deeper connection with, that spoke to you, not necessarily in a way that you understood, but in a way that kind of held out the promise for something greater to be connected to you at some point in your life. Am I at all close on that?
Well, let's see here. And I should say that while I'm hoping that you can hear me perfectly well,
which
I'm still having the strain to catch every word. So, you know, as clearly and loudly as you can speak, that will work here would be great. Second, with regard to that, you're going right after one of the more intimate and important experiences of my entire life. And I think how I'm reading your question, Jeff, is that you're really kind of asking, was there some sense of the transcendental or some sense of spirit, if you will?
Yeah, absolutely right.
Yeah, present in that experience. And while I do actually have a very strong felt sense of the divine as well as a reasoned belief in the divine, in that particular experience, I honestly would have to say, I think it was more about my psychology, my family, and my own nature as, maybe this is where I'll slip something transcendental. And my own nature is, I think, kind of an old soul in a young body, at that time at least. Now I have an older body, 57-year-old body, as it were. Maybe I'm a young soul now in an older body. But in any case, that was more personal. But I think what it speaks to that is more universal and is often, I think, for people infused with something transcendental, something divine, is this profound and fundamental longing for true happiness and a conviction that it's possible, as well as a recognition that it's obscured or otherwise unavailable here and now, in whatever situation we're in or in whatever psychology we have. So in that sense, I would definitely give you a thumbs up, you know, for your characterization of that. And I'll go away after this phone call, actually, and wonder a bit about that experience for me and reflect on to what extent there was something at work there, you know, bigger than the psychology of a six-year-old kid.
Oh, well, I'm glad to hear that you'll take that in.
Yeah.
Now, there's a lot to chew on here, but let's try and do this in an ordered and a simplified method, because really your book, it just cuts through with so much clarity on subjects that most people would probably shy away from.
Thank you.
And I like the way that you kind of wrap this all around, or I don't know if that's the right word, or maybe what seeps through is the Buddhist philosophy, the Buddhist perspective. And to begin with, you start talking about the three pillars of Buddhist practice as being the wellsprings of everyday well-being, psychological growth, and spiritual realization. And among them, those three, and perhaps you could expound on them, are virtue, mindfulness, and wisdom.
Okay. Well, you got it, and I could see the way this interview is going to be. We're going to be right at the heart of the matter in a lot of ways, because you have a real feeling for it, and you're going right after it. For those who know about Buddhism, you're exactly right. Traditionally, the three pillars of practice in Pali, the language of Buddhism, early Buddhism, the first written record, is sila, samadhi, and panya, or virtue, concentration, and wisdom. Sometimes concentration could be construed as mindfulness. And you're exactly right. If you think about it, I have a friend who, I'll say it like this. If you think about it, those are really the essence of the good life, you know, to be upright, virtuous, you know, to have good character, to not harm yourself or others. That's what virtue boils down to, pragmatically. Buddhism, as you know, is not particularly a theistic frame at all. It's very pragmatic. So virtue is seen not based on avoiding sin or because, you know, God said you ought to do something, but rather because virtue promotes happiness and welfare for yourself and others, in kind of utilitarian and pragmatic terms. But if you are virtuous and you also do have a steady mind and you are even able to enter deep states of absorption, because that's certainly central to the ultimate levels of practice, I think, across all domains, and also you have wisdom, you're going to be a happier person. And I have a friend who's a Christian minister, deeply trained, and he's also a professor in Christian contemplative practices. And he said that in Christian contemplative practices, they use almost the exact same three words for the kind of three pillars of practice there. In part, and this is where there's an example of a linkage to the, to the material in my book, it's interesting that those three, virtue, mindfulness, and wisdom, quite closely correspond to the three fundamental functions of the nervous system,
mm-hmm.
which is to say regulating, learning, and selecting. You know, regulating is very close to virtue. Learning is the essence of mindfulness because neural structure is built in particular for whatever is in the field of focused attention, for better and for worse. So as we gain greater and greater control of our attention through mindfulness and concentration, we're more able to take control of how we build structure in our own brain, which has enormous and very, very intimate implications for what it feels like to be you or me or anyone, right? And then last, choosing, you know, selecting. That's the essence of wisdom. Or one way to put the nature of wisdom is that it's a matter of choosing a greater good over a lesser one, you know, day by day, minute by minute. You know, as the Tibetans say, if you take care of the minutes, the years will take care of themselves, right? So, yeah, that's exactly right. And, in effect, what the book's about is how to build up, using your mind alone, in everyday life, in the trenches with kids, traffic, jobs, emails, phone calls, families, whatever, to build up the neural substrates of those three fundamental pillars of the good life, personal growth, and spiritual transformation.
Yeah, and then in another part of the book, again, very much towards the beginning, you again are letting this Buddhist energy into the conversation. And I quote from the book, quote, "It's a remarkable fact that the people who have gone the very deepest into the mind, the sages and saints of every religious tradition, all say essentially the same thing. Your fundamental nature is pure, conscious, peaceful, radiant, loving, and wise. It is joined in mysterious ways with the ultimate underpinnings of reality by whatever name we give that. Although your true nature may be hidden momentarily by stress and worry, anger, and unfulfilled longings, it still continues to exist. Knowing this can be a great comfort." I almost get the feeling that you're like a big brother that's reaching out a hand and saying to the reader of your book, "I want to give you something that will make your life easier because it has for me." Is that sort of close to...
Well, you're very kind to say all that, and you're really touching my heart here, truly. By nature and also by, you know, training for many, many years as a therapist and also, a spiritual practitioner, there's a genuine humility there, and so I'm a little careful about some of the connotations of, you know, big brother or the sense of, you know, hierarchy or I don't know what, something like that. But that said, the best aspects of what you're saying, you know, the desire to offer something I've learned myself and to be useful and a sense of relationship with the reader of the book, absolutely. I think there's a term in Buddhism that's appropriate here, Kalyanamitta, which means spiritual friend, or going back to my many years of rock climbing and guiding and taking many, many people, I think of the metaphor of the guide, you know, someone who has been down the trail before and is in a way that's very kind and kind of horizontally related. In other words, as a peer on the path, is showing you some of the twists and turns and helping you over some of the rough spots. That's really true. No doubt about it.
Yeah, I like that energy and that symbol of guide. That is so much more, it of course is saying that I've gone someplace, but I can also show you how I have traveled further up the path.
Yeah, and as well, any author, I think, really tries to be a conduit, a pipeline for good material flowing through. And, or a relatively transparent window for the light to shine through, if you will, without too much, you know, obscuration or clutter or dirt on the window or grime. But anyway, so much of what I'm really trying to communicate here is at least is the things that make me go, oh, my gosh, this is fantastic, you know? And a lot of what I just consider, oh, my gosh, this is fantastic, is the deep wisdom in the spiritual traditions, particularly the ones that, you know, particularly coming from the contemplative part, not so much the theological or philosophical aspect, but the hard-won lessons on the cushion, you know, across traditions. I'd rather read the saints than the theologians, in other words. And second, the amazing breakthroughs in brain science over the last 20 years, especially the last 5 or even or 10. And third, the, oh my gosh, of how to translate that intersection of contemplative practice and modern neuropsychology, how to translate that into practical things people can do to make their lives better. That's where I'm just trying to share that, you know. And I will say that the brain is sexy, you know. The brain is big these days. It's in the news, you know, people write about it and so forth. But most of the writing about the brain that I've seen, it's particularly in the kind of popular media, is either inflated with a big kind of gee whiz thing, or where they're making claims to push a point one direction or another, or it's kind of strictly theoretical. It's interesting that they found some particular spot in the brain, or, you know, for example, you can manipulate the brain to create out-of-body experiences. But so what? You know, for me, the really important thing, and where the rubber meets the road, is to translate this brain stuff into practical tools. You know, and that's really what I tried to do in the book, and that's what it predominantly is. Plain English, as I could do it. You know, in my mind, to be quite honest, you know, I imagine a reader who is living in the Midwest, maybe has a year of college, maybe has more, maybe has less. That's my reader, you know? And if I can, that's a lot of my relatives, actually, from North Dakota. And so if I could talk to that person in plain English without putting on airs, then I feel I've done a decent day's work.
Yeah, and also, I mean, like, you know, the writings of Ernest Hemingway, that's not easily done. And I find the clarity in your book, and again, as I say, I'm really not someone who has a strong science background, but I could follow everything you were saying because of the examples and the stories that you tie in the new concepts with, that it became crystal clear for me as I'm reading, oh, that means that. And that was extremely helpful and, of course, made the book so much more enjoyable for me to read. But I want to get back to, again, this Buddhist perspective. Now we've just talked about the three main Buddhist concepts of virtue.
Mindfulness and wisdom.
Thank you. Thank you. I couldn't find that. And now I just want to go to, you know, Buddha said that life is suffering. And so then he expressed the suffering results from cravings. And those are expressed through what you're saying are the three poisons, which is greed, mm-hmm. hatred, and delusion. So to me, it's like you're kind of looking at both, you know, how to live the life, but also what is it we need to be further away from in order to have what it is we really truly want, which is probably happiness and existing in this world in a loving manner towards all we meet. And then what you really have a lot of self-interest in this for the reader, because you're also talking about being much more aware of how we're harming ourselves. And in that, you talk about the first and the second dart of how we add our reactions to unpleasant experiences. And perhaps you could talk a little bit about the first and second dart.
Right. Well, let's see. That's a great summary, actually, the first the second and third chapter, the two chapters on suffering. And before I talk about the distinction between the first and the second dart and why that's so useful in daily life, I just want to clarify something. While many people have said, just as you did a moment ago, you know, quite reasonably, that the Buddha said that life is suffering, technically, he actually said something a little more nuanced, which is that he said, one of the noble truths of life is that there is suffering. In other words, it's not that he said, how can I put it, that everything is suffering. It's just that there is suffering, and there's a lot of suffering, and there's an inherent suffering in life. I guess that would be the fundamental, you know, that's the first noble truth in a nutshell. So that said, the question is, why is there suffering? Because both, you know, the Buddhist analysis is very focused on causes and processes, okay? And that's also the scientific analysis and the pragmatic one. You know, what causes, what hurts and what helps, right? Why does it hurt? Why does it help? And then, for how can we increase helping and decrease hurting? That's the pragmatic, you know, conclusion you draw. So in that light, one thing that I did that I found, for me at least, the most fun and intellectually creative is I took a hard look at suffering through the lens of evolutionary neuropsychology. In other words, why did our ancient ancestors, you know, monkeys, squirrels, you know, reptiles and fish, basically, and then all the way back 600 million years to the earliest jellyfish who had to form nervous systems so their sensory apparatuses could connect with their motor apparatuses. You know, why do we suffer? How is suffering developed? And because when you understand why you suffer, you can do something about it. So then to jump forward to your point about the two darts, basically one reason we suffer has to do with irreducible, unavoidable, inevitable discomfort, physical or emotional, because organisms need to know when they're out of balance or the boundaries between themselves and the world have been breached, or when they're not getting the rewards they need, or there is a threat that's coming at them, right? In that sense, pain is a signal. And there is inevitable pain, discomfort broadly defined in life, ranging from very subtle forms of physical or psychological pain all the way, you know, to something that's agonizing. Okay, that's the first dart of life. And the Buddha said basically you can't avoid a fundamental minimum of first darts in life. But the second darts of life, which is to say our reactions to the first darts, and second, our reactions to life altogether, even when there's no first dart to be found, even when something good has happened, like someone's paid you a compliment and so forth, it's our reactions to life, including our attempt to essentially freeze what's endlessly changing and impermanent and transient and so forth, or to pull out one part of life, you know, and make it somehow special and distinct from the whole, in particular the part of life we call the I, the me, the ego, right? That when we do that, when we get our knickers in a twist, right, over little stuff, then we start throwing second darts all over the place that land on ourselves and other people. And that's the primary source of suffering. And that's the part of suffering that we can actually really do something about. For sure, we should, you know, avoid the first darts when we can, you know, ranging from taking aspirin if you've got a headache to fix the leaky roof, right, so the drip doesn't keep you awake all night. But honestly, most of our suffering is self-inflicted. And what's wonderful is if you can appreciate the causes of second dart suffering, which are that I unpack in the book, in your own brain, right, then you can start doing something about them. You can start dealing with the way that the body gets activated in its stress response systems. You can do something about the cognitive appraisals of the world and yourself and the past and the future and change those. You can do things about the ways in which the negativity bias of the brain due to evolution preferentially looks for and remembers negative experiences compared to positive ones. You can do something about that. You can do things in your relationships with other people. You can learn to steady the mind because we evolved a kind of ADD brain, you know, because that's how our ancestors survived. You can do something about that as well. So anyway, I hope I didn't go on too long there. But, you know, the thing to appreciate, I think, maybe to kind of close on this point, is that, you know, honestly, I look out there in the world and I see that probably most people spend most of their time, you know, trying to get better at things that don't matter very much. Or investing themselves in things that really don't matter very much in terms of their own benefit and welfare or those of other or that of other people, and not much time on the things that would help them a lot. So I think that, you know, if someone's willing to spend 10, 20 minutes a day, usually 30 seconds here and 2 minutes there, on, you know, on what the Buddha called wise effort, you know, increasingly uprooting the causes of what's painful, harmful, and increasingly planting the seeds and encouraging the cause of what's beneficial and happy, right? If a person does that day in and day out, it will build up over time, you know, to something really fundamental, including through changing the person's brain.
You know, I just want to let people know that there is a lot of science in this book, and it is very well explained. I'm understanding it. It's just that there's so many new terms that it takes a little while to really receive them all into the brain, at least my brain. But I just want to read a little bit of this, just so people get a flavor and a feel for how the book is written, as well as the clarity with which it comes across. And you have a kind of a boxed area here that's set off from the type of the page itself, and it's entitled The Evolving Brain. So you say, life began about 3.5 billion years ago. Multicelled creatures first appeared about 650 million years ago. When you get a cold, remember that microbes had nearly a 3 billion year head start. By the time the earliest jellyfish arose about 600 million years ago, animals had grown complex enough that their sensory and motor systems needed to communicate with each other, thus the beginnings of neural tissue. As animals evolved, so did their nervous systems, which slowly developed a central headquarters in the form of a brain. Now I want to skip down here to another part, and you say, cortical tissues that are relatively recent, complex, conceptualizing, slow, and motivationally diffuse, sit atop subcortical and brainstem structures that are ancient, simplistic, concrete, fast, and motivationally intense. The subcortical region lies in the center of your brain, beneath the cortex, and on top of the brainstem. The brainstem roughly corresponds to the reptilian brain, seen in Figure 2. As you go through your day, there's a kind of lizard, squirrel, monkey brain in your head, shaping your reactions from the bottom up. So, even if I don't understand all the scientific words that are being spoken there, I certainly got that there's a lizard, squirrel, monkey brain in my head shaping my reactions.
Your inner iguana, right? You're channeling your inner iguana.
That's right. Something. Yeah. There's a smorgasbord of activity going on. It's not just, you know, one central thing that's happening. And that, to me, just in a playful manner, brings that right across, even though I got the science behind it.
Mm-hmm. So, well, thank you. It's funny. One of the things that, for me, is a huge takeaway from learning about how the brain evolved, is self-compassion, so in Buddha's brain, I actually have in the first chapter, I think there's a section on self-compassion, in effect, actually that's more a little bit about getting on your own side. I think the one that follows is actually an exercise. There are a lot of guided practices, in the book. But self-compassion is really important because you realize, poor sweet brain, it's trying so hard. That inner lizard is talking to, honestly, the inner mosquito, because mosquitoes have nervous systems too. I mean, one funny thing is that to appreciate our connection with all beings in the plant and animal kingdom, is that truly we share about 20% of our DNA with that in a banana.
Oh my gosh.
And let alone I don't know what it is exactly, but I bet you probably ballpark 50% of our DNA with a freaking lizard, right? And so when you get that, you realize, wow, it's a wonder that I can walk and talk and chew gum at the same time, And so then that moves you to a kind of very powerful sense of compassion for yourself, not wallowing in self-pity or any of those pitfalls, but rather the sense of, a kind of, wow, I wish I not suffer. I wish I be happy, combined with this attitude of sympathetic concern, which studies have shown is really important for building up resilience, and as well as improving mood and managing depression and things like that. So that's one of the takeaways for me, is self-compassion.
Mm. Oh, yeah, absolutely. I got that very strongly in the book. And my guest today on Planetary Spirit is Dr. Rick Hansen, who is a neuropsychologist, author, and teacher, and the author of Buddha's Brain, The Practical Neuroscience of Happiness, Love, and Wisdom. We're going to take a short break now, and then we'll be back in around 5 minutes to continue talking with Dr. Hansen about his book, Buddha's Brain. Dire Straits, whose album Brother in Arms, and the cut was Why Worry? And my guest today on Planetary Spirit is Dr. Rick Hansen, PhD, who is a neuropsychologist, author, and teacher, and he founded the Wellspring Institute for Neuroscience and Contemplative Wisdom, and teaches at universities and meditation centers in Europe, Australia, and North America. And his website is www.rickhanson.net. That's www.rickhanson.net. And his latest book is entitled Buddha's Brain, The Practical Neuroscience of Happiness, Love, and Wisdom. So I wanted to talk a little bit about, you're talking about pulling weeds and planting flowers. You're really now starting to get in the book about what we can do to start moving towards happiness and away from sadness, away from the three poisons, you know, greed, anger, and I forget what the third one is.
I'm sorry, Jeff, I got that you want to talk more about practical steps in the book in terms of happiness, but then I lost the last little part of what you said.
Oh, okay, sure. Pulling weeds and planting flowers.
Right.
Mm-hmm. How that concept has to do with actually moving towards happiness in one's life.
Right. Well, could I give you two examples?
Please do.
Okay, great. And these are practical practices that or methods that people can do on their own. Well, you know, so by pulling weeds, I think there we're talking about reducing our negative reactions to things. And with regard to planting flowers, we're talking about encouraging wholesome responses or encouraging positive mood, outlook, and so forth. Okay, so with regard to pulling weeds, one of the things that I think is useful to appreciate is the degree to which we evolved to react fairly intensely to anything that seems threatening or anything that is upsetting to us. And it doesn't have to be a tiger in the bushes. It could just simply be a frown across the dinner table. So one way to pull weeds, quote unquote, is to gradually train the body to have a calmer, less reactivated, less triggered, less upset response. And that involves getting more control over what's called the parasympathetic wing of the nervous system. Basically, we have a part of our nervous system kind of keeps us on an even course, and it has two major wings. One's the sympathetic fight-or-flight stress response system, and the other is the parasympathetic rest-and-digest system that actually restores us to balance. So we live in an age and in a culture that is the sympathetic nervous system on overdrive. Everything from multitasking with lots of interruptions and the go-go pace of modern American culture, even modern Western culture, as well as, honestly, a fair amount of threatening messages, many of them exaggerated, that come at us through the media. So for all those reasons, we tend to be, you know, on chronic sympathetic overdrive, which is very bad. We evolved to be able to handle short-term bursts of stress, but long-term chronic stress is very bad for physical and mental health. So the antidote to that is parasympathetic activation. So I'll name a couple of great practices that I use. One is long exhalations, because the parasympathetic system handles exhaling. So if you make your exhalations longer than your inhalations, inhalations are handled by the sympathetic stress response system, you naturally draw yourself into a more relaxed, peaceful, centered, grounded, even-keeled way of being. You know, it's really hard to be very upset about something after 3 to 10 long exhalations. Second, relax the tongue. As I said, the parasympathetic system is the rest and digest system. So digestion starts with the mouth, and the tongue is full of parasympathetic fibers. So if you relax your tongue, that's going to help stimulate the parasympathetic nervous system. And if I could, I'll use this to make a really important point here, which is that if you stimulate some neural substrate, in other words, the underpinnings in the brain of some mental state or a psychological state of interest. If you stimulate a psychological state, you're going to that you care about, that you like for example, relaxation, you're going to stimulate the neural underpinnings of that psychological state. And now here's the key point. When you stimulate the neural underpinnings, you actually strengthen them over time. Because in the famous saying from the psychologist Donald Hebb, neurons that fire together wire together. In other words, if you get the neural underpinnings of a mental state you care about, like happiness or love or wisdom, going, and you do it particularly over time, you really get those neurons to start stitching together and build out new structure. For example, people who meditate routinely have thicker brains in the parts of the brain that have to do with controlling attention and self-awareness, tuning into the body in particular, for example. So, you know, if people use these methods, they can be confident that they're building muscles, in a sense, between their ears. So that's an example of pulling weeds. Should I go on now to one example of planting flowers, one method for planting flowers?
Oh, sure. Please do.
Okay, great. So, planting flowers, as I said, I think in the very beginning, kind of fast because I tend to turn on the fire hose when I'm talking with people, we evolved a negativity bias, which is what scientists call it, inside our own brain. Or as I put it, we've evolved with a brain that is like Velcro for negative experiences, but Teflon for positive ones. That's because for our ancestors who are dealing with, let's say, carrots and sticks, if they miss a carrot today, they'd probably have a chance at a carrot tomorrow. But if they failed to avoid a stick today, whap, no more carrots forever. So while carrots, in other words, positive experiences or rewards or opportunities are certainly important, from a pure survival standpoint in the Serengeti or over millions and millions of years, going all the way back to those jellyfish, right, you know, frankly, sticks are much more crucial. So the brain is really, really good at looking for sticks and reacting to them and then storing those reactions in memory for fast-tracking at anything that remotely looks like a stick. The problem is that while that's a great strategy for passing on gene copies, it's a terrible way to have quality of life. And it also really gets in the way of spiritual practice. Because if you're preoccupied with feeling threatened, feeling uneasy, with being vigilant and all the rest, it's really hard to bring awareness into doing practices that are spiritually transformational. So one way to plant flowers to defeat the negativity bias and to train the brain to become more like Velcro for positive experiences with Teflon and Teflon for negative ones that slide off, you know, like water off a duck's back. A great way to do that is taking in the good, and which I love so much, I devoted the fourth chapter, an entire chapter to it. And that is the idea that in three simple steps, as you go through your day, turn good facts into good experiences rather than, in other words, just letting them, you know, go by. Or, you know, just noticing them but not feeling it. You know, you got to feel it to really build up these memory traces. Second step, savor it. 10, 15, 30 seconds, really stay with it. Because as any teacher knows, the best way to remember anything is to make it more intense, more multimodal, in other words, throughout your whole body, and more sustained. So if you do that in the second step, you're going to build up that memory trace. And then the third step is sense and intend that the positive experience is sinking into you. Any single time you do that will not change your life, usually. But half a dozen times a day, just looking for all the little opportunities, for as you said in your opening prayer, for a moment of gratitude or for a recognition of your own accomplishments or a recognition of a sensing of other people being good to you or a recognition of your own good qualities. Those are all opportunities, at least half a dozen times a day, to take in the good and gradually, over time, fill that hole in your heart.
Yeah, and also you talk about that in 1974 you started, you began meditating. Mm-hmm. And my understanding is now that on a weekly basis you're actually leading meditation. So I wasn't all that surprised when I saw this information about the brain and how meditation actually activates various parts in the brain to do all these, and you've kind of got these bullet points of the positive qualities that result from regular meditation.
Mm.
Would you list those, perhaps?
Oh, sure. Well, it's cool for people. I mean, most of the people probably who are listening to this have some kind of spiritual practice, and it's really, I think, great to appreciate the fact that of all the possible mental activities out there, the one that's been studied the most, really, for its impact on the brain is meditation. There are literally several thousand studies on different kinds of effects, both momentary and then, more to our conversation here, enduring effects of different forms of meditative practice on the brain. Most of the studies have been done on either transcendental meditation or on more Buddhist mindfulness kinds of practices, but there are also studies done as well on other sorts of things. So out of all that, a quick summary here is, first of all, regular meditative practice changes the brain itself in some important ways. One, as I said earlier, it makes the executive systems of the brain thicker. In other words, people become more able to control attention and to, you know, control themselves in general in healthy ways. Second, it thickens the part of the brain called the insula that's in charge of sensing the body and also in charge of empathy for the emotions, the feelings of other people. Also, the brain changes in terms of a greater degree of activation in the left frontal areas, which are associated with improved mood, because the left frontal part of the brain puts the brakes on negative emotions. So if you build up the brakes, right, on negative emotions, you're going to get more happiness. Another very interesting change is that you get more gamma wave brainwave activity. And what that means is that you get more synchronization between groups of neurons in far-flung regions of the brain at the rate of 30 to 50 or even more times per second, which correlates with a more global sense of integration and unification of awareness. Those are just some of the, and there are also different kinds of brainwave patterns that are noted, but I think those four that I've named here are probably the premier findings in terms of enduring changes on the brain.
Hmm.
Additionally, people who have a significant practice of prayer or meditation, prayer and meditation both being a contemplative practice, also have improved immune system response. They're more able to fight off colds and flus.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
They tend also to get better regulation of the cardiovascular system, which helps protect it against stress and probably has some kind of benefit long-term for heart disease. And then those physical bases also correlate with a lot of mental health benefits. One of the things people can do if they want, they can just get to my website through BuddhistBrain.com. And on that website, I list a number of scientific papers in the public domain that are kind of like the greatest hits of what I call neurodharma. And and among them are some nice review papers in plain English where people can see listed some of the many findings about the psychological benefits of meditation, which include, for example, increased mood, increased self-reliance, increased self-confidence, greater resilience, greater capacity to, you know, cooperate productively with other people, et cetera. You know, it's interesting, you know, I really do believe that meditation is to mental health what aerobic activity is to physical health.
Hmm.
It's absolutely fundamental.
Hmm.
And my hope is that we will increasingly teach it in schools, and worldwide, increasingly, people will take, you know, at least a minute a day is my rule of thumb with people. Make a solemn vow that you'll meditate at least 1 minute a day. You'll never go to bed without doing whatever is formal meditative practice for you, 1 minute a day or more. And then it would make this world a better place if everybody in the world, you know, over the age of 10, spent at least 1 minute a day meditating.
Mm. Mm. That's a nice goal.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, I see where your first book is entitled Mother Nurture, A Mother's Guide to Health, mm-hmm. in body, mind, and intimate relationships. And it feels to me like nurture is at the heart of this book, Buddha's Brain. It feels to me like you are kind of reaching out to the reader in various ways. You've got all the scientific backing and information at the fingertips in a clear, concise manner so that if somebody is, you know, logically minded, they can certainly sort through this and grab hold of everything they need in order to chew through this information. And then you also offer meditations in different ways to approach loving kindness, to approach just relaxation and learning to, you know, become kinder, calmer, and more just relaxed. And you also have this understanding of the Buddhist nature that, you know, kind of fits very nicely into the mix here. So I get a sense of spirituality, although it's not overt and it's not, you know, kind of in your face. It's certainly pervasively in between the lines there, and there is a loving kindness energy that I detect. That the way this book was written, it was written as a guide, as a helper, to allowing people to live much more enjoyable lives that will allow them to then flower in whatever way they were given their gift to come forth.
Well, again, I appreciate that, and you're quite complimentary, although I totally hear your sincerity. And I think, I mean, I appreciate you saying that. My intent certainly was to be nurturing and appreciate the fact, honestly, that so many people these days, you know, me included on a bad day, can feel beleaguered, overwhelmed, pushed, you know, like, oh my God. And most people, I think everyone way down deep, and most people even all the way up to the surface, have good intentions and are trying hard to make their way in this world of wonders, you know, where there is suffering, to be sure, at a time in the world that is full of many wonderful opportunities and positive trends in the media, and yet still is full of peril, full of difficulty, and full of reasons to fear for the life, you know, our children and grandchildren will have, you know, or children and grandchildren more generally around the world, whether they're mine or other ours or other people's. So against that backdrop, I think it's important. I think kindness, it's like the Dalai Lama said. I mean, he means the word kindness both superficially and in particular, he means it very profoundly. But I think that, you know, what the world needs now, as the Beatles said, is love. You know, what the world needs now is kindness. And I think where kindness starts, and this is definitely a Buddhist view, and I don't think Buddhism has a monopoly on this view, where kindness starts is at home. It starts with ourselves, the person we see in the mirror, the person we talk to inside our head, often much more harshly than we would ever speak to anyone else or tolerate anyone speaking to us. And kindness starts with the people, you know, we wake up next to in the morning and look at across the dinner table or, you know, in daily life or see in daily life. And so, yeah, if I can in some small way, you know, contribute to the growth of kindness in the world today, you know, I'll be very happy about that.
I like this one part also in the chapter under the title Cooling the Fires, where you speak about finding refuge. And you say, you know, in this life, where have you found refuge? Refuge include people, places, memories, ideas, and ideals. Anyone or anything that provides reliable sanctuary and protection, so you can let down your guard and gather strength and wisdom. And then you go on to talk about refuge, which I don't think people think of as refuge. So perhaps you could just talk a little bit about that, different places or...
Thank you.
Yeah.
Well, first, in all the spiritual traditions of the world, one thing they have in common is an appreciation of sanctuary or refuge. You know, places, whether it's at the top of a mountain or in a Catholic cathedral somewhere in Europe or anywhere around the world, or a Zen temple, or frankly, or at a home altar, that it's important to find places where people can, physical places, where people can really go to feel safe and nourished, empowered, protected, and inspired. It's also important to find refuge inside your own mind. And that's where the Buddhist practices of the three refuges are really nice, I think, where you take refuge essentially in the teacher, the teaching, and the community of the taught. Buddha, Dharma, Sangha. And you can apply that whether you're... No one needs to be a Buddhist to read my book. You know what I mean? I mean, the Buddhist parts of it are kind of in the background. They provide, I would say, the skeleton, you know, in many ways for the book, around which I wrapped a lot of, you know, muscle, if you will, and some fat, I'm sure, and hopefully some skin.
Not much.
That's very widely accessible. But for a lot of us these days, I think taking refuge, I take refuge almost every day, and not just in Buddha, Dharma, Sangha, but some other things that are personally meaningful to me, and including the divine. I take refuge in the divine and God. I think that that's a very powerful way to feel better, and of course, since neurons that fire together wire together, to build up the neural underpinnings of that internalized sense of relationship with those things that are refuges for us. And I think if I could say this, and I say more about this in the book, one way to put refuges is something that we go to. That's good, that's fine, but it also is dualistic, and it kind of puts it out there. Another way of relating to refuges is that they already exist within oneself, and it's only a matter of sinking into them or abiding increasingly as them. And when a person has that felt sense of God or a spirit entity or, you know, your voice in their head or, you know, some internalized sense of wisdom, you know, teachings that make sense to them, their own version of the Dharma, or a sense of being with other people, you know, that are very supportive, or honestly, a memory of their grandmother making cookies, or a sense of jumping off, you know, the pontoon into the lake at summer camp that was always associated with a sense of joy and aliveness. Those are all very powerful forms of refuge that tap what is called these days embodied cognition. The idea that the deepest layers of thought are sensate and emotional. And so if we shore up our positive sensations and emotions and kind of balance the fact that we tend to internalize a lot of negative sensations and emotions, you know, due to the negativity bias. If we do shore up those positive sensations and emotions, then increasingly, you know, we abide as those refuges. And then, quite happily, other people are more able to turn to us as refuges for them.
You know, we have just a couple of minutes left, but I would love to have you talk about what I consider to be a new definition of strength, of feeling strong. You say strength is two primary aspects, energy and determination. And you talk about having taken a break from college and you're taking a dozen school kids backpacking through the Yosemite High Country. And you talk about how you discovered your strength, your inner strength.
Mm. You're asking me to talk about how I discovered my own inner strength?
Yeah, if you would.
Well, let's see. Many ways.
I mean, in this particular story.
I'll think about a couple that are maybe really useful for people listening. To borrow a saying from medicine, you know, well, there's a saying in medicine that says essentially good judgment comes from experience. And experience comes from bad judgment. So one way to build up strength is first to learn from experience. You know, there's a saying in psychology, you know, some rats are one-trial learners, right? I think some people are one-trial learners. They learn the first time. But a lot of people, honestly, are 10-trial learners or infinite-trial learners. They keep doing the same thing that's not good for them or others over and over again. So I think learning from one's experience, and to do that, you need to have self-compassion and not too much self-criticism. There's a place for a little bit of self-criticism, but more than a little bit floods the system and blocks learning from your experience.
Got about 30 seconds left.
That's cool. The second thing is, honestly, I've really turned toward the highest teachings. I've always been drawn to the saints, as I said, rather than the theologians. And the last thing I'd say is that I've done things where, you know, I had to stretch myself, whether it was rock climbing or wilderness activities or long meditation retreats. You know, you build character, right, by taking on appropriate challenges.
Well, I would really encourage people to take on the challenge, and I don't even consider it that. Take on the joy of picking up Buddha's Brain by Rick Hansen, Ph.D., along with Richard Mendius, M.D., and learn about the practical neuroscience of happiness, love, and wisdom. And thank you, Dr. Hansen, for being my guest today on Planetary Spirit. This has really been quite enjoyable. Thank you. And if you're enjoying this program and would like to access past interviews, go to planetary-spirit.com for on-demand archives of past shows. And my guest today on Planetary Spirit has been Rick Hansen, Ph.D., who is a neuropsychologist, an author, and a teacher. And his book is entitled Buddha's Brain, the Practical Neuroscience of Happiness, Love, and Wisdom. And his website is www.rickhansen.net. And I believe it's also www.buddhasbrain.com. So, we'd just like to thank everybody for listening and also let you know that this coming Tuesday, my guest will be Nicole Breaux, my in-studio guest, who is a youth development specialist and professional singer. And so, this is Jeff Ferranini saying, have a blessed day.